From 90.9 WBUR, this is a special edition of Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Megan Irons, Boston Globe City Hall Bureau Chief.
Well, we are live once again at the Healy Library at UMass Boston because this November, Boston faces a significant choice. Re-elect Mayor Marty Walsh to a second term or turn to a new leader.
We're hosting two conversations with the major mayoral candidates. We want to hear about their lives, their records, and their visions for the ever-changing and growing city. Yesterday, we heard from City Councilor Tito Jackson. Today, we'll hear from Mayor Marty Walsh. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And our mayoral candidate conversations are hosted by WBUR, the Boston Globe, UMass Boston, NBC Boston, NECN, and Telemundo Boston. We'll get to Mayor Walsh shortly, but first, David Cash, Dean of the John W. McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies. He's got a brief welcome for us. And Dean Cash, hello. It's good to see you again, and thanks for hosting.
Great to see you, too. Thank you, Meghna and Megan Irons from the Globe, and thank you to our co-sponsors, NBC Boston, NECN, and Telemundo Boston, and welcome, Mayor Walsh. The pair of conversations yesterday and today is an example of the many ways that McCormick Graduate School and UMass Boston carry out one of our central roles as convener of civic discussions that matter to our citizens. It's often said that municipal elections are the most important because decisions made at the city level most directly impact our lives and shape our sense of community. They determine our educational options, how safe our streets are, what kinds of job opportunities we have, where and how we live, how we get to work, how our communities can thrive, how we play, how clean our air and water is, and how we grow up and grow old. We've convened these discussions to learn how our candidates for mayor think about these and many other topics. We hope you enjoy these conversations. And now I'll turn it over to Meghna and Megan. Thank you.
Thank you, Dean Cash, so much. Listeners, I should let you know, and viewers on our live stream as well, that you can send us your questions for Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Send us a tweet or comment on our Facebook page at Radio Boston. Use the hashtag BossMayor17. And for those of you here in our live audience, we are also taking your questions on note cards. And in fact, Mayor Walsh, the first question is going to come to you from the audience off a note card. Someone wants to know something that I think a lot of us want to know. What is the biggest thing that you've learned about yourself throughout your first term as mayor?
Oh, that's a great question. That's a hard question to answer. I think one of the things that I said at my state of this when I first got sworn in the first day, I think I've become a better listener. When you're the mayor, you have to go around the city of Boston. You have to listen to people. It's not all about telling people what you think is right or wrong. It's about listening. And I think if you listen well and your administration listens well, you can do a lot of good things for the city of Boston. And we've learned it in so many different issues, which we'll talk about today, about how we move forward. But I think listening is probably one of the best things that I've learned I guess I knew about myself, but I really had to master it.
What is a top priority for you going into your reelection? What do you want to accomplish that you did not accomplish in your first term?
Well I think the first term, we really used it as a roadmap to the future for all Bostonians. And, you know, we did a lot of planning. We have the Imagine Boston 2030 plan. Mm-hmm. We have the Climate Ready plan, the Arts and Culture plan, the Transportation plan. So we've done a lot of planning moving forward. I think that in the next 4 years, it's continuing the work that we've already done, whether that's continuing to create low and middle income family housing, whether that's continuing to improve the quality of our schools in the city of Boston, whether that's looking at the infrastructure of our city when it comes to bikes and pedestrians and making sure that our Vision Zero policy is truly carried out where we have safe streets. On our public safety side, continue the diversity of the police department that we've done and continue the work with the police department as far as building up relationships in the community. So I think that we've laid the foundation down for an awful lot. And now it's about how do you continue that work moving forward. And I think that, you know, we have some great people working in the city, and we have some great folks working with us in the city in order to do things like that.
So let me ask you if I can, Mr. Mayor. You told the Boston Globe recently that you felt overwhelmed during your first three months in office. It's a great quote. You said, "I literally went home every night for the first 3 months and said, oh, my God, what have I gotten myself into?"
Yeah,
so it's a couple years later, so why do you want a second term?
Now let me expand on that. So So my first 3 months in office, I was, I guess when I say this, I wasn't completely aware of the press inquiries that would come my way. And the tenacity.
You've been in the State House. How could you not
be
aware of that?
Yeah, but the tenacity of the press coming my way. That was one thing. The schedule was crazy as well. Trying to balance the office with the community. And I couldn't talk to anyone about it. Laurie was here with me today. She spent, 9-10 months of her life going 24 hours for me. And everyone that was close to me was working campaign full time. So I couldn't let my guard down and say to somebody, this is, I don't know how I'm going to quite manage this, because everyone and everyone around me was helping me. But it took a little while. I mean, the first day in office, first day I was there, I had a public safety meeting, which I did have, and we were able to, we had that meeting. And about an hour and a half later, when everyone left, after the swearing in and everyone left, one of the lawyers from the Corporation Council came down and said to me, "You have to make a decision if you are a host or surrounding community for the casino." And I'm thinking, well, the casino vote happens in November. It got defeated. Why do I have to deal with that? And I never realized that we hadn't moved on Everett. So now I'm in the middle of a casino conversation, and then trying to set up the operation, making sure that we live up to the promises I made with diversity of my team, and making sure we bring in the right people. So for the first 3 months, it was very daunting. After 3 months, it became less daunting, and I focused my life. I lived my life a day at a time, and I realized that this is a day at a time for me to do to get this job right, and I feel comfortable. I love the job. In the next 4 years, I'm going to love every day of it, assuming the people of Boston love me and put me back there. So hopefully they do.
Mayor Walsh, this is from our audience as well. Is there one thing that you're most proud of in the time you've been in office?
Yeah, there's a lot of things I'm proud of.
I'm going to throw an end part B, your greatest misstep so far.
Okay, part one, part A. I think looking back on my 3.5 years as mayor, there's a gentleman sitting in the crowd here today. His name is Anthony Wheeler. Anthony Wheeler is previously homeless. He's a homeless elder. He was on the streets for 17 years. After we had to close the Long Island Bridge, which was an awful decision that we had to make in the city, we actually looked at our homelessness, the way we deliver homelessness, and we created a system that helped us house homeless vets and then homeless people, chronically homeless folks on the streets for a long time, for decades. We've housed over 1,100 people. In the day I got sworn in as mayor of the city of Boston, there were 1,100 people that are now in a home that were living on streets, under trees, under bridges, in staying warm. And today we've been able to put a system in place to house 1,100 people. I think is one of the greatest things we can do. We've affected so many people. That's number one. And on top of that, ended chronic veterans homelessness by doing that. And on the pace to ending all chronic homelessness by the year 2018. And we can do that in Boston. We're going to do that in Boston. The greatest misstep, I guess, there's a lot of things I would like to look at doing differently. I think the misstep.
The Olympics?
No, that's not a misstep.
IndyCar?
That's not a misstep. The misstep is probably waiting a little too long to bring in a superintendent of schools. John McDonough, who did a great job as interim when I took over, there was an editorial in the Boston Globe that said, keep John McDonough for another year, and I did. I kept him for 2 years. Again, not that John wasn't doing a good job, but Tommy Chang has some great vision for the future of the city, and in his year and a half as superintendent has really done some incredible things. We have more level one and level two schools right now in the city of Boston than any other period in the history of our city. We have more kids going to school at top level schools. So I just think that 1 year of losing that leadership potentially, as far as a new vision, hurt us a little bit. But we're catching up, and we're going to continue that growth in the second part. The Olympic piece, you talk about the Olympics, that's something I inherited. When I came into the mayor, I was already under the process. The city and state were already in the process of moving forward towards the Olympics. I made it very clear in the Olympic conversation, Boston pulled out of the Olympics. We pulled out of the Olympics because there was a document that the International Olympic Committee wanted me to sign that would say if the Olympic Games didn't happen or if something were to go wrong, that the city of Boston would be responsible for any shortfall that happened. That would have been a shortfall anywhere from a $2 billion to a $5 billion shortfall. I felt, and I've said it in the very beginning, I felt that that was something I could not sign, and I could not mortgage the future of the city away. We have a AAA bond rating in Boston for the last 4 years. I've run a very tight economic ship in the city of Boston. We don't spend money bad, so I'm not going to sign a $5 million note. In saying that, what the Olympic conversation forced us to do is really look at opportunities. And what it did for us is White Hat Circle is an opportunity potentially for economic development and future growth in the city of Boston. Harambe Park in Roxbury, where they were going to put the tennis facility, is an opportunity. We're renovating that park now, state-of-the-art renovation that's going on there. Our transportation system, which isn't completely controlled by the city of Boston, but we need to partner with the state because we need a reliable transit system that isn't completely reliable 100% today, and we need to continue to work with the state so we come up with a plan to have the T first rate.
Mayor, sorry, I just want to jump in because we were going to hold the Olympics till later, but here they are. Because, I mean, you did recently tell Boston Magazine that if it happened now, you'd still go for it again.
What I want to know
is, you just a minute or two ago, you talked about how the importance of listening in terms of your job as being the leader, the mayor of the city of Boston. But it's exactly that thing that I think a lot of Bostonians who were opposed to Boston 2024 felt that you weren't doing, that you weren't listening to them and their concerns about the economic cost of hosting if the bid had been successful. I mean, what do you tell them?
They were absolutely right with that. And as mayor of the city of Boston.
But they felt that you weren't listening to them and their concerns.
But I was listening because at the end of the day, we didn't go forward. And I think that that's very important.
But not because of the concern they had about the economic cost if the bid had been successful. That's what they were worried about. They felt that the money would cost Boston too much to host it.
It wouldn't have. The way that the plan was written for the 2024 games is very similar to the plan that's being written right now in Los Angeles, California. The difference is Los Angeles has a lot of infrastructure. So I'm hopeful that Los Angeles gets the games because it's great to bring the games back to the United States. I think what's happened with the Olympic conversation, again, am I going to go for it in 2032? No, we're not going to go for it. What I'm saying is I have bigger things to do here as mayor of the city of Boston. Education is more important. Creating more housing is more important. Making sure that we deal with climate change is more important. Ending homelessness is more important to me. I looked at the Olympics as an opportunity, potentially, for growth in our city. We were looking – let me just finish this point.
Sorry.
We were going to have to create 17,000 units of housing for Olympic Village. 17,000 units of housing that when the Olympics are over after 4 weeks, because it's 2 weeks of the Olympics and 2 weeks of Paralympics, we would have 17,000 units of housing for moderate and for middle and low income residents to be able to go into, buy, and move forward. We would have had to have had an MBTA that's up to speed by the year 2024. It would have given a deadline date for the T to be brought up to speed. That would have had to happen. And as far as White Hat Circle, that's where they were talking about Olympic Village at that point, and then Harambe Park next to Franklin Fields. All of those would have had millions of dollars of private investment. This isn't public money. This is all private investment that was going to go into these areas. And again, it didn't happen. And I think the people that obsess about it are the press, because they're like, oh, let's talk about the Olympics all the time. And it didn't happen. And in about a week, there's going to be Los Angeles probably and Paris are going to be chosen as the 2024 host and the 2028 host.
But going back,
and then
to
we can stop talking about the 2024 games in Boston.
Mayor Walsh, we were talking about if you had regrets. You took the city through a very divisive, some would say, period over this Olympics, over the cost, over what it would do to communities. Would you really do this again
Let's talk about that, Megan, because I think that the divisiveness that happened during that time, a lot of it was driven by certain not reporting both sides of the fence. And I think there was a lot of people that when those meetings happened for the Olympic conversation, there was more people in the room for the Olympics than against the Olympics. But again, it didn't happen. Hey, let me just back up. I'm going to end it here. I didn't move forward. I listened to the folks that were concerned about the Olympics. I would listen to the folks that were concerned about what would cost the city of Boston. I listened to those folks because at the end of the day, we pulled out of the bid because I wasn't willing to sign a document that stated that the city of Boston would pick up any overrun. Now, that overrun would be in building stadiums. That overrun would have been building infrastructure. That overrun would have been building housing. That overrun would have been when if the games got canceled altogether. So we did not move forward on it. And it was Marty Walsh, the mayor of Boston, that pulled the plug on that.
So I know you want to move forward, and we do too, but
really?
But again, I keep coming back to the question of leadership. So let me just rephrase what I was wondering a little bit. Would you do anything differently if you were to do it again?
Oh, yeah. See, it was already started prior to me being the mayor. We already...
Yeah, but once... So, but I mean, if you were to do it again, would you do it differently?
The first questions I would ask is the financial model and seeing if the IOC and the USOC were willing to change the financial model of what they were going to do. They put a plan out. When I say they, the United States Olympic Committee and the International Olympic Committee put a plan out to change the financial structure of the games after Russia. because it cost $52 billion or something to build those Olympics. So this model was a downgraded model that they were talking about. I would have had those conversations long before we even put an application in the very beginning. Yeah. When I became the mayor, the application was in. It was already filed. It was moving forward.
But wouldn't you acknowledge then that you could have focused more on your education priorities? For instance, if you weren't so focused on the Olympics, or you'd be able to do some of the things that you had on your list to do.
Let me tell you how much time I focus on the Olympics. When you're the mayor of the city of Boston, you don't have the luxury of spending a lot of time focusing on issues like the Olympics. You have to spend a lot of time focusing on any issue that comes in front of you. In the course of the day, I spend a lot of time on a lot of different topics, as we'll find out today what I do. As mayor, you can't focus just on one issue. That's why you bring people in and around you that are experts and smart in those fields so they can move forward. I think as mayor, I don't think the people of Boston want to elect a mayor that's only focused on one item at a time and can only handle one issue at a time. If that's the case, then whoever's running for this job is running for the wrong job.
Well, shockingly, there are other issues that possibly we should be talking about here. But I appreciate you engaging on the question of what the process of Boston 2024 meant for you and the city. So let's move to the thing that I think we get continuously the most listener and viewer response to, and that's the question of affordability and housing.
Yeah.
Lots of conversation and questions about that. Now, your administration has facilitated the construction of more than 13,000 units in the past 3 years in
19.
Boston.
19,000.
Okay. 40% of them, your administration says, are affordable. Lots of questions from listeners and viewers online about this. You know, some of the folks point to developments where they see affordable housing being branded as housing for those earning up to $58,000 to $72,000. And I'm getting a lot of feedback from folks saying that they don't think that's affordable. How do you fix that? And in fact, yesterday in our conversation with City Councilor Tito Jackson, he actually said he thinks it's time for the city to reconsider what it means by affordable. What do you think about that idea?
I don't think we have to redefine it. I think we know what affordable is. I think we know that a family that earns $58,000 a year might seem like a decent amount of money on paper, but you can ask any person in this auditorium or young person in this auditorium looking for an apartment. Some of the apartments are going for $25,000 and $3,000 a month, and $58,000 isn't going to give you enough to be able to be able to afford some of those homes. When I came in as mayor of the city of Boston in 2014, one of the things that we realized working with Sheila Dillon and Chief of Housing was looking at how do we make sure our city stays affordable for folks. We were growing. We had companies wanting to move into the city. We had young people, millennials, wanting to stay in our city. We've had people that went to college here wanting to live in our city. We had baby boomers moving back to our city. So we launched a housing plan to look at different areas of housing. And one was creating the 53,000 units of new housing by the year 2030. That plan was about working with our college and universities to build on-campus housing, to free up housing stock in neighborhoods such as Alston and Brighton, parts of Dorchester, Mission Hill, areas where some of those neighborhoods are being overrun by students. And the people that own those homes are raising rents in those areas, charging students $1,000 a month, where there was four and five and six students living in an apartment. And that was $6,000 a month, where that prices families out of neighborhoods. And we've seen it over. This has been going on for decades in those neighborhoods. So that was one aspect of our plan. Second aspect of our plan was looking at how do we create more senior housing in the city of Boston? So seniors who live in homes today that might not be able to maintain them anymore, how do we make sure that they have an opportunity to live in a senior apartment building that is affordable for them? And that, again, that frees up additional housing stock in communities. We looked at publicly owned land and how do we get the land costs down. And the Department of Neighborhood Development looked across the street, found 600 parcels of land across the city of Boston that right now we're building 1, 2, and 3 family homes on for first-time home buyers, the most ever in the history of the city. We're looking at some of our other ways of building homes. I brought in the business community, the inclusionary development, and we talked to them. They were building 13% affordable off-site or on-site, and we changed that to 18%. And since we've changed that model, and I want to say early 2015, we've raised over $71 million in money that's gone into low-income housing and mostly low-income housing. the Community Preservation Act in 2001, the city of Boston went for it. That was a tax, 1% surcharge on all the homeowners in the city of Boston. In 2001, the city council and the mayor went for it. They didn't get it. They lost at the ballot box. In last year, 2016, we did the same thing, and it passed. 70% of the Boston residents supported that, where we're going to have $20 million additional a year that's going to go into affordable housing, open space, and historic preservation. So when you think about the investments that the administration that I have is made, we've made $100 million of investments in housing. Now,
how are you defining housing, Mayor Walsh? I mean, how are you defining affordability, Mayor Walsh?
Affordable, low income, and moderate income. Low income is somebody who is either, whether if they're not working, you know, they're on a Section 8 or some type of assistance. We're working on in our housing, Boston Housing Authority. We have the one of the largest housing authority, our largest in the Northeast, not including New York City, and we're having our low income families move in there. We're working with other low income providers. Also, families who earn anywhere from zero to I think it's zero to $40,000 in low income, and say 40 up to $100,000 in middle income. Those are all people we should be doing. I mean, if we don't work, and I don't agree with the premise that we shouldn't focus on somebody making $58,000 a year, because if we don't focus on somebody making $58,000 a year, before you know it, they fall into. We want people to increase their wealth, not lose their wealth. And if they're spending all of their wealth in housing, then they're not going to have ability to be able to live and put food on the table and do other things. So we not only have to work to lift up the people that have disadvantages, we also have to make sure our middle class stays a middle class.
Well, so to that point, actually, we have a question from a listener, Cameron. Cameron sent us this question. When will you be building fewer luxury high-rises and stabilize rents specifically to keep the middle class within city limits?
We actually have stabilized rents. Last year, we made an announcement that our rents in Boston stabilized by 4% because of our housing stock. As a city like Boston, it goes back to the question of the Olympics. We have to be able to do both. We have to be able to walk and chew gum, if you will, at the same time. We can't just say, okay, we're going to stop building high-end housing and just build low-income housing. We're going to continue to build the housing in the city of Boston. Continue to press where we can to get additional revenue into making sure that we want to continue to build moderate, low-income housing all over the city of Boston, because we want to continue to lift it. And it's not just housing. Let's be honest. Let's go take a step back. We created the Office of Economic Development. We can provide a house for somebody, but if they don't have a job, then they're even at a bigger disadvantage. So we're working on creating more opportunities for jobs as well, and trying to bring in some jobs here that have different types of skill sets so that we can get our people back working in the city of Boston. Our unemployment rate is pretty low, but in certain parts of our city, our unemployment rate could be as high as 9%. So we have to, and the reason why it's 9% is because people don't have the skills for some of the jobs that are out on the market. And we have to work to, if we want to lift people up, it's about lifting everyone up at the same time. That's what we have to do.
Mayor Walsh, your campaign sent out literature that says that during your administration you created 60,000 jobs. Yeah. Is that accurate?
Yeah, 60,000 jobs.
Are these all City Hall jobs? Are these all private sector jobs? What's the link to City Hall?
I mean, City Hall is only, there's 18,000 city employees work for the city. We don't have, don't have beyond that.
How did you create these 60,000 jobs?
Working, bringing companies into the city of Boston, all the tech companies, all the new companies. Our Office of Economic Development has attracted all kinds of companies. We had Reebok that's moving into the city of Boston. We have ASIC moving into the city of Boston. We have General Electric that's moving into the city of Boston. We just announced the other day that Amazon's moving into the city of Boston. We have tons of tech companies that have come into the city that are making investments here in the city of Boston, staying here. We have other companies that are growing in the city of Boston. In the time that up since 2014 to today, 60,000 new jobs have been created in the city of Boston.
And you had something to do with that? Your administration?
Well, I mean, of course we did. I mean, we've making a culture here that people want to be here in the city of Boston.
Well, so
if they left, we'd be saying you chased them out, probably.
Well, underlying the question about housing and jobs is the bigger sort of issue that ties it all together, which is inequality in Boston. And your own report, Imagine Boston 2030, had some pretty stark numbers in it, right? And just I said them yesterday, but they bear repeating today, that the median net worth for white Bostonians is $247,500. $3,000 for some Hispanics and just $8
for Black families.
Yeah. I mean,
it's awful.
So beyond the question of housing, I mean, we could also spend a whole hour talking about housing, but really, what more can you do? What more are you going to do to close these gaps?
I mean, again, I've been mayor for 3.5 years. This gap has grown prior to me becoming mayor. It's not something that you can resolve in 3 years. It's probably going to take realistically a decade to actually make some real input into closing some of those gaps. We've done a lot of different programming that we have in the city of Boston. We have job training program that we've worked on with programs like Building Pathways and Operation Exit, strengthening those pathways into the building trades. We opened the Roxbury Innovation Lab over in the Boland Building. That was something that some people were kind of questioning, why would we open an innovation lab in the Boland Building? Well, if it's good enough for the South Boston waterfront, it's good enough for the downtown area, it's good enough for the Roxbury community to have an innovation lab there. And again, young people going in there with ideas. We're working on strengthening our free community. We put together a program for free community college that any graduate from Boston Public Schools that has a 2.0 GPA can sign up for Roxbury Community College, Bunker Hill Community College, or Mass Bay Community College and go to school for free. That includes fees. And if they can get a 3.0 GPA while they're in school, they have to graduate in 3 years, they keep that get that GPA up to 3.0. We're working with institutions like University of Massachusetts, like Boston University, to allow them the opportunity to go on to further education with less debt than what some of the students have put up with today. So the answer is job training program. The answer is education. The issue of inequality, income inequality, is not a simple solution. This is a nationwide problem. Certainly, it's one that people are struggling with. But when I look at us in Boston, what we're doing, we're laying down a lot of great foundation. Those 8,000, nearly 9,000 units of moderate and low income family housing, that's a big step. That's the most in the history of our city. Making sure that we're creating, bringing more jobs to the city of Boston, and making sure that we're spreading those jobs around is the first time or the lowest in a long time in the history of our city. Having free community college has never been offered in the city of Boston. And what you're seeing now is the state has picked us up after this, and they're working towards us. I grew up in a 3-family house. My mother and father come from Ireland. When I moved into my house in Taft Street, my mother, and everyone knows the story, we moved in the same day. My father was renting it. He had a chance to buy it. I think he bought it in 1968. He paid $17,000 for my house. My father was an Irishman from Ireland. He was a laborer. He got dirty every single day. He went to work every single day. We didn't grow up rich. The difference was that he had an opportunity to go to work every single day. He was able to raise his 2 boys. He was able to put food on the table every single day. We didn't have fancy things, but we had a roof over our head. We have to make sure that what the immigrant population did in this country a long time ago, we have to make sure that we create that opportunity, not just for people coming to this country that are new, but for families, long-standing families. We have families in Roxbury that are third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth generation family that are still struggling. We have to do better than that. I would argue that my administration over the last 3 years has done more in the last 3 years than a lot has done been happening in this city over the last 3 decades.
Well, you talked about that when you were campaigning, about the stark difference here in Boston when you go from Eggleston Square to South Boston. What difference have you seen over the 3 years that you've been mayor in places like Roxbury, in places like Mattapan and parts of Dorchester, which have been struggling economically and with high unemployment and violence and all of that stuff?
I think we've seen the unemployment numbers go down in those neighborhoods, and I think we've seen the overall violent numbers go down in those neighborhoods. We've seen the numbers of arrests in those neighborhoods go down by 37%. I know that we'll talk about violence in a little while, I'm sure, and talk about the spike that we're seeing today. But at the end of the day, in the last 3.5 years of my administration, 37% fewer people have been arrested. So you can just imagine how that's helping us in keeping our numbers down. We're working towards City Council Ayanna Pressley filed before I became the mayor. She filed the liquor license law that allowed us the opportunity to get control of more licenses in Boston. When I became mayor, we were able to pass that legislation as well as take control of the liquor license board. The very first round of licenses that we put out there, unfortunately, we didn't get anybody from Mattapan wanting to open a restaurant in Mattapan with a liquor license. We did get a couple in Roxbury that were able to get some licenses over. That's why now we're refiling a piece of legislation that's going to specifically focus in certain areas of the city of Boston to allow to build these restaurants in these restaurants. We're not going to let them go downtown, not going to go to the North End, they're not going to go to Southie, they're not going to come to parts of Dorchester. They're going to be earmarked for areas like Mattapan, Four Corners, where you live.
bigger up, you know, there.
other areas that are important, and we have to help to continue to build wealth and can help businesses continue to build wealth. We've also, through our small business opportunity, we've created the Office of Small Business under John Barros' shop, and in that shop we're helping build wealth there, helping people be able to start businesses. We changed the way that we do contracts in the city of Boston. We did executive order to make sure that people of color, women, and veterans have access to contracts. When I became mayor, that number was dismally low. That was like, I think it was at under 1%. And today it's about over 1%, but we have to continue to encourage helping people build their wealth.
So I want to move on to education here in just a second. But given what you just said, a listener sent us this question. It's more of an invitation to you, actually. Lorraine Wheeler wants to know, Mayor Walsh, can you tour Blue Hill Avenue with me? She says, worn out retail, missing buildings, and absentee owners. Despite hot economy, we can't even get a coffee shop. Maybe she would be glad to hear what you just said. But
no, Lorraine,
would you
absolutely,
tour?
Lorraine, I've been out in Blue Hill Avenue tons of times. I mean, I absolutely will meet you out there anytime. You call my office tomorrow, 635-3151, and I will get out to Blue Hill Avenue with you. It will not be my first time out there. There's some major investments being made in Blue Hill Avenue right now. We're working with the city and the state and doing some streetscape out there. We're working to make sure that we keep the Blue Hill Avenue clean. We have a Main Street district out there that's robust. Yes, Blue Hill Ave in Mattapan needs some assistance, but it's also on the verge of, we've had more interest in Mattapan in the last year and a half than we have previously to that. So that's exciting to hear, and we're going to continue to work with the elected officials. Your elected officials out there, Danny Cullinane and Russell Holmes and Timmy McCarthy and Linda Dorsina-Forey, and Andrea Campbell, they're all working extremely hard to make sure we bring services and things. But I absolutely will call the office, and I will absolutely love to walk with you.
You talked about liquor license reform and how it's key to bringing vitality to some neighborhoods, but Mattapan has struggled with this. Yeah. There's no restaurant right now that serves alcohol.
I said that.
I know. Making that point again, what are you doing
Well, I mean, again, it's about getting people to come in. I mean, you can't just drop a liquor license in there and say, okay, now we have a restaurant there, go in there. You need to get people interested in opening and businesses that want to. There's been some businesses in Mattapan that we approached them to see if they wanted a liquor license or a beer and wine license, and most of them said they don't want to deal with it. They don't want to deal with it. I don't know. You have to ask them. Hmm. But again, it's a special, unique. We have to get the first couple in there. I mean, I'll give you an example. In Dorchester, Ashmont Station, Ashmont area, the Ashmont Grill came into that area probably 15 years ago. It took literally about 14 years for a second restaurant to open, and the second restaurant was Tavlo, which was Chris Douglas who opened that restaurant. Mm-hmm. And what we have to do is continue to build supports, and we've been doing that in the last 3 years by giving our Main Streets additional money, additional resources, and additional supports to help them beef it up. I mean, Mattapan is a Main Street district. So not only is it just a business district, it's a Main Street district, which that means that there's more help going into that area. And we've been assisting them, the Main Street district, to help them encourage businesses to come into those neighborhoods. I think people are tired of dollar stores. I think people are tired of those stores in their neighborhoods. I hear it about Roxbury. I hear it about Dudley. I hear it about Codman Square. People want to see some other businesses coming in. Mm-hmm. You know, pharmacies, God love them for being in there. They come in, they fix it up nice, but we need to bring some other businesses in. We have some great businesses in Grove Hall, small startup business. We have some great businesses in Eggleston Square with clothes lines and shopping businesses. And we also need to encourage people that live in those neighborhoods to shop in your business district, because you can't start a business district if people aren't going there. And we try to encourage that at Christmas time and throughout the year. Buy gifts in your local business district. Don't go to the mall. Go to your district and
Mayor,
buy some stuff in there.
I don't want to give education short shrift here because it's such a major issue for Bostonians. And let's just get right to kind of one of the major criticisms that we heard from your rival yesterday, City Councilor Tito Jackson. His basic argument regarding the funding for Boston Public Schools is, he said that when you take into account inflation, schools have actually just been level funded overall. And so that he argues that means that you haven't necessarily meaningfully increased the budget and schools don't have the resources they need. What's your response
to that? No, we've increased the budget every single year in the school department since I've been mayor of the city of Boston, number one. Number two, the schools that have been receiving less money next year. The reason why they're receiving less money, their enrollment has dropped. Parents' choice, school choice is working in neighborhoods. People have been able to move their kids from what they feel a school that wasn't appropriate for them into level one and level two school. But let me back up a little bit here. When I think of education, I think of birth through at least high school. and now college. We have some things. So just real quick, I'll run through it. Working with the Black Philanthropist Fund to make sure there's a program out there so mothers, when they have their children, we give them the tools they need, the education they need to be able to read to their kids, help their kids from age zero to four to five, so we get them into pre-kindergarten. We're working with the Black Fund. It's not part of the city. They're doing it separately. Working on a program to get into hospitals across the city of Boston, really giving family, young families, the tools they need to help their children. So when their children start pre-kindergarten, they're not starting on way behind. They're listening to the same amount of words as an affluent family does. Mm. We have a program.
Mr. Mayor, actually, let me just jump in here. I take your point about education being from the moment of birth, but I do want to focus on BPS specifically.
I'm moving.
But let me just ask you, because BPS issued a report last fall that said that the district is going to fall short some $20 to $25 million in terms of a budget gap every year if fundamental changes to revenues and expenses aren't fixed.
Let me get to that point. If I can get just real quickly, I need like 3 minutes. I'll get there. All right,
you're gonna have to take less than 3 minutes.
No, it needs to be 3 minutes. We can't just brush over education.
No.
We put 750 new seats for universal pre-kindergarten inside our school system. We have a bill at the legislature right now that would take funding from the convention center. If we got that bill passed, we'd be able to have universal pre-kindergarten in our city.
But the governor is not even is the governor on board with that plan?
I don't know. You have to ask him that. Yeah. I'm telling you what a plan is.
Yeah.
We have 125 school buildings in our city. We have 22 different grade configurations. We have 22 different start times. We're all over the place. We launched a plan called Build BPS, a $1 billion investment in our schools where parents, teachers, students, and the community is going to talk about what they want to see in the school district, their models, what they want to see moving forward. We're looking right now. We did it. We're looking at our transportation costs in the city of Boston. We have 20. When I say 22 different start times, that means that we have 22 different schools start times in our city. So you know that's when you see bus go down the street, down the avenue in front of your house, and you see the bus half full or three kids on it. The reason why it's half full because there's no other school in that proximity that they can make these work. There's an opportunity for us to if we can streamline our transportation costs, that money will be reinvested back in the schools. If we can look at the costs that we're putting in all of our schools, all 125 schools, that some places we're replicating services, some places we don't have enough services, and work to deliver a better system, we'll be able to take that money, reinvest in our schools. We're putting money in. We put $143 million into Boston Public Schools over the last 3.5 years. We put $207 million into all education. The $56 million of education that went into charter schools went there because we got short reimbursed. We didn't get the full reimbursement from the state, and we have to pick up the tab for that. So what we're trying to do is work with the state as well. In 2013, they fully reimbursed charter school funding to all districts in the Commonwealth. 2014, they started to cut back on Boston and other places. There's 11 of us getting hit hard. 14, 15, 16, 17, all of those different years we've been given less reimbursement for charter school reimbursement. Because the way the law is written, we have to pick up the cost. So when you think about education, we're making investments in education, and what we do, we need help. To go back to your point about the governor and the legislature, this is something that they should be doing. We're talking about pre-kindergarten. If it's good enough for New York City, it should be good enough for Boston, Massachusetts. And this money, it's sitting there in a pot over there collecting money. There's no expansion of the convention center. I'd like to see that money come back to the city of Boston so that we can invest in our kids. If people want us to continue to be the tech capital of America, Boston, Massachusetts, we have to make sure that our children are prepared for that. And it can't be just Marty Walsh, the mayor of Boston. It has to be all of the folks. And one last thing I'll say about education funding. I've been lobbying at the State House for the last 4 years for additional revenue, and I've seen maybe one or two other elected officials lobbying with me. So if elected officials are concerned about education money, go with me to the State House next time and advocate on behalf of the kids of Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, Hyde Park, Boston, all over the city of Boston.
Mayor Walsh, when you campaigned in 2013, you said you wanted to make every school in Boston a quality school.
Yes.
How close are you to accomplishing that goal, or is there a long way to go? Where are you on this?
No, I think, you know, our graduation rate's the highest it's ever been in the city of Boston. And certainly in this year, going into school year 2017-18, we'll have 26,000 kids, lower elementary kids and junior high, I guess, if you will, more of them going into level one and level two schools than level three schools. So we're seeing a lot better quality of education around our kids. We also extending the day for 26,000 of our kids. When I ran for mayor, we talked about the shortest school day in the country, or one of the shortest school days in the country. We no longer have the shortest school day in the country. We have all of our schools will be expanded into longer days next year. When I say next year, in September. So we're going to have more education time for our kids in the classroom. And we also have a program going on this summer called Fifth Quarter, where over 10,000 kids are learning and also going to summer camp. So our kids don't lose their education that's happened. They're going to go back to school in September, having gone through this program and staying ahead of the game, so they don't take that first few weeks of catching up on what information they've lost.
So shall we talk about public safety a little bit before we run out of too much time? Because Mayor Walsh, you mentioned it a little bit earlier, that crime overall in Boston is at a 20-year, roughly two-decade low, but homicides are up slightly. 26 homicides as of the 16th of July compared to 23 this time last year. I mean, I just wonder what can be done, what more should be done.
Let me just say, you know, when I look at the numbers of homicides, and we're able to tell a story, okay, we're only three over last year. With 26 homicides, 26 mothers lost their kids.
And if you 27 yesterday with the,
whatever the number. Oh, 27
with the Mission Hill.
Yeah, the number I gave was as of the middle of July.
27. All right, 27 mothers have lost their kid. 27 mothers' children have been involved in a homicide. So, 54 in this case, more than 54, but a lot of family devastation there. You know. One is too many. Our goal is zero. I start my morning every single morning, Monday through Sunday, talking to Commissioner Evans. Every day he's the first person I speak to. We talk about what happened the night before. We talk about a plan for the day. We talk about what's going on in our city. We talk about the violence. We talk about the guns. We talk about the kids. We talk about the programs. We talk about everything you can imagine talk about, because it's something that we obsess about. That's the one thing that takes up most of my time is the public safety. In May of this year, May 23rd, we had a meeting with the community, with organizers, with clergy, with different nonprofits out there, and we talked about a summer strategy plan, and we implemented it, and we went out there talking about it. You know, summer was moving along fairly peacefully, and then July 4th we came, and we had an uptick in violence, and it appears that since that time, it's gotten a little bit quieter, although, you know, two days ago we lost a great member of the community in Mission Hill, a business owner who was apparently being robbed, fought off a bit, and he got shot and killed by three cowards who came into the city to kill him and rob him, a hardworking man.
Andres Cruz.
He was recognized by the Mission Hill business community. So in saying all this, you know, this is one of the parts of the job that keeps me awake at night. It's the only thing that keeps me awake at night. The Olympics doesn't keep me awake at night. IndyCar doesn't keep me awake at night. This keeps me awake at night because I feel it's my responsibility to make sure people in our city is safe. Part of that's through education. Part of that's through creation jobs. So what we try to do is working extremely hard on community policing, on creating programming. A lot of the job training program that we have in the city is out there to get young people off the street. Operation Exit is a program I started with the Building Trades. We have about 60 graduates so far that have gone through that program. Not one of those young people. They all have queries. They all have long records. They all, if you look at them on paper, say, oh, my God. Not one of those young people have reoffended yet. We have to take programs like that and expand them even more. We have to make sure we continue our Office of Financial Empowerment. We have to continue to work with our Boys and Girls Clubs. I mean, I love seeing the number of arrests down by 35%, but, you know, more has to be done. The issue of guns.
Mayor Walsh, can I interrupt you for one second?
One second, Meg, please. The issue of guns is a nationwide problem. We've held three gun summits as mayor of the city of Boston, first time in the history of us doing that. We are getting guns coming into the city from the north. We are getting guns coming into the city from the south. We are getting guns coming into the city from the west. We're working hard to get these guns off the street. We have to stop the flow of guns into these streets. You have a Congress that's ineffective to work on these. You have a congressman that was shot, nearly killed in Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago. Another congressman was on the field. They asked him about gun control. One of his colleagues was nearly killed, and his comment was, well, we can't really mess around with the First Amendment. We have young people in America, and most of those young people are black and brown boys, are killing each other. This is a national public health crisis that needs to be addressed on a bigger scale.
Yeah, I was going to say your opponent has made the shooting closing rate an issue in his campaign, yeah. saying that it's not enough. It's not. You talked about the homicide closing.
I'm more concerned about closing, not having shootings in the street than closing the shooting rate. I think it's more important for us to get the guns off the street and focus on getting all those guns off the street. That's the important piece here.
But are you satisfied with the 15%?
Of course not.
Yeah.
How would I be satisfied with that?
No.
Who in their right mind would be satisfied with that? Nobody is. I'm not satisfied that we don't have 100% clearance rate on homicide. One of the candidates that was running for mayor of Boston that she didn't get her signatures, Mary Franklin, has spent her entire life fighting for justice for the killer who killed her husband. You and I know that. I would love to be able to get the person who killed her husband and be able to give Mary Franklin a little bit of peace. It's not going to take her husband back, but these mothers and fathers that have lost their loved ones, not knowing who killed them, that certainly doesn't make me happy at all.
Well, how do you fix that? What can be done?
It's a hard issue to fix. I mean, yeah. it has to be a comprehensive plan, and quite honestly, we need help from everybody, and that's something that we're going to continue to reach out on. But again, it comes down to taking guns off the street. You know, the week that President Trump was writing executive orders on immigrants and Muslims and banning Muslims and all the things he was doing in Washington, no one paid attention. But he undid an executive order that President Obama did on national background checks. And all that background check that President Obama did was forced that anyone who's buying a gun in America would have to wait 72 hours to get their gun so that the business could do a background check. Now, they might not get it done, but if they didn't get it done, the gun will be sold. He reverted that. He reverted that. That was helping us a little bit. That wasn't the answer to all. But we're not talking about stopping selling guns. We're doing a background check so people with mental illness and people just aren't buying them by the truckloads and driving them down the highway and driving into Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, and streets of Boston and dumping them in the streets. We got to stop that.
But just a follow-up on what Megan was asking about the closing rates. I mean, specifically, the arrest rate for non-fatal shootings is 16%-ish. And as you know, Commissioner Evans says he thinks the department can do better.
No, we can.
So
it's very difficult. I mean, we
But
have,
what should the department specifically be doing to improve the rate?
I think it's a difficult balance because what we need is help from people who understand who's doing these shootings. And people are afraid to talk about who are doing these shootings.
But, you know, for some people in the community, it sounds like you're heaping the responsibility on them.
See, I love that. That's perfect. Thank you for doing that. I'm glad.
Don't you think?
No,
I
don't.
Have people told you that?
I'm glad you threw that.
I asked you about the department, and you immediately said, we need people out in the community to talk to us.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that seems to be the quick answer. So if we're not
getting... That was my response to your answer.
But if we're not getting help from people in the... I'm not saying everyone. In the community, these guns are illegal. These guns are not traceable. These guns aren't necessarily, if we can trace these guns back to somebody, we don't know who they belong to because they're illegal in the street in the first place. So it's very difficult for the city to be able to do this. And at the end of the day, what we have to do is cut down on the guns in our city.
Point taken, but what can the department do
They do it every day.
What improvements can the department make to convince the community that they are good faith partners in this so that more people do come forward?
Well, we build a relationship every day. It's not even about that. I mean, I think there are people that will come forward. I just think they're afraid to. It's not even about wanting to come forward. I think people are just concerned about it. I mean, you know, again, it goes back to some of the work that we have to do. We're doubling down on our efforts on the street worker program to get more street workers in the streets to find out what's going on in the neighborhoods. We're working with young people, trying to continue education for young people. This is not a simple solution. And quite honestly, the debate we should be spending, we just spent the last 4 minutes on this. We should be focused on what are we doing about the unsolved murders, because those are the ones that there's somebody else on the other side of that.
How much money in this year's budget is for additional street workers?
I'm not sure. I think we put on – I'm not sure what the exact number is.
But you're going to hire more?
No, we have street workers on the street now.
Are you planning on hiring more, you said?
No, I said trying to get them into the streets doing more.
To do more work, yeah. But not more street workers. Can I just ask one police question? Well,
let me just say one more thing, just so everyone's clear here. When a young person or a person gets shot in the city of Boston and they're brought to the hospital, I don't know if you had to have a conversation with the police department or ask the victim themselves about who did the shooting. Oftentimes, they will not talk to the police department. So if you have somebody who's been shot that's unwilling to talk to the police department, it's very difficult for the police department, unless there's a camera in the area that might have caught the shooting, to be able to find out who did it. And I think that's one of the questions that I would suggest that next time we're reporting is you go to the hospital, you talk to a person who's been shot and ask them, who did this to you? And that you'll hear back. Again, a lot of it goes back to fear. We have more work to do in our city to reduce the violence. We have to continue to build relationships with the community. The community's gone through enough.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. So what we want to do is make sure that people in the community feel comfortable and safe, that we're doing everything we can to make sure they live in a safe neighborhood.
Do you think the city needs more police officers? Should we have more officers?
I think at some point we have to look at attrition rates. I think we're in the process right now of just barely keeping the numbers that we have because we have a lot of officers retiring. I would like to see more specialized, not so much police officers, but also specialized public safety enforcement in our city. Not necessarily policing, more public safety, continuing to build relationships and continue to get information.
Well, in the last couple minutes that we have, Mayor Walsh, I just want to switch back to politics for a moment here. Now, two of your aides are going to go on trial, accused of trying to extort union jobs from the Boston Calling Music Festival. It's a federal investigation, and several listeners and online viewers have submitted this question. Has Mayor Marty Walsh ever testified before a grand jury?
This is an ongoing legal process, and I'm just going to let this play out in court.
Don't you think the public has a right to know
again,
whether or not their mayor testified
Meg,
before?
Meg, you've asked me this question. I don't know how many times you've asked me this question.
I will keep asking.
And my answer is going to be the same. This is a legal process. And we're going to let it play out. I'm proud of the work we've done in the city of Boston. I'm proud of the accomplishments we've done in the city of Boston. And I'm going to let this is a sad situation, but I'm going to let it play out in court.
Okay. So we'll keep asking.
Thank you.
Now, City Councilor Tito Jackson, as you remember, he endorsed you when you first ran for mayor.
I wish he was endorsing me this time.
Are you surprised that he's challenging you?
Nothing really surprised me in politics anymore. You know, I think Tito's ambitious. You know, certainly he's done a lot of great work in the city over the years. I mean, I was proud to have his endorsement in 2013. He was very big in the campaign, supporting me. I came on after the primary. But, you know, I can't fault anyone. It's the greatest job in the world. I mean, anyone who wants to be mayor of the city of Boston, you should go for it. I mean, it's a great job. I love it. You can do so much good. You can help so many people. And I think that, you know, I think having opposition is good as well. I think it keeps you fresh. It keeps you on top of things. It forces you to look at issues like clearance rates and how you would make sure we work better to have clearance rates. It forces you to look at issues around education and how you'd strengthen the education system. It forces me to look at issues around you know, climate change. We didn't talk about climate change today, but, right. You know, Washington's pulled out of climate change. We're not. Boston's doubling down on our efforts.
Well, in fact, I'm looking at the clock here, and that is all the time that we have for today. So we'll see what happens this fall. Mayor Marty Walsh, thank you so much for joining us for this conversation.
Oh, this is
today.
Great.
Thank you, Mayor Walsh.
And I want to thank all the people here today and the people listening at home. I hope you liked what you heard. But whether you did or didn't, just do me a favor. Go out and vote in September. Go out and vote in November. Be part of the process. It's important for us as Americans, as Bostonians, that we vote.
Well, I also want to say thanks to Megan Irons, my colleague here,
City Hall
Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Also, thanks to our co-sponsors, the McCormick Graduate School at UMass Boston, NBC Boston, NECN, and Telemundo Boston. Thank you to our audience online, on the air, and at the Healy Library here at UMass Boston.
Thank you, Anthony.
That's it for today. I'm Megan Chopper-Gardy. This is Radio Boston.